Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is L.A. Steele. Lila won't be with us tonight. She's baking pumpkin pies and getting ready for tomorrow. So, I wanted to mention that this is actually our fourth year anniversary here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm quite happy about that. It's quite amazing, actually. And it's been a full 4 years. That's great. But I got to touch on some news tonight. I don't really have an interview for you tonight, but we have a number of news clips that I'm going to play. Bring us up to date on a few things. The first tonight that I want to talk about is the Goldman Sachs. The largest ever insider trading probe targets Goldman Sachs. And this is the insider trading charges are being prepared against a vast network of consultants and traders across the U.S. financial industry in a year-long probe that a report suggests will reveal a pervasive culture of backroom dealing. The investigation should be the largest insider trading probe in U.S. history. The Wall Street Journal said Saturday, citing people close to the issue, with federal officials examining if multiple organized insider trading rings reaped illegal profits of tens of millions of dollars. Some charges could be brought before the end of the year, the journal said. And I'm going to read this article. This is from Red Ice Creations, which is the blog that I'm picking this one up from. The criminal probe is examining some three dozen companies in the probe, which is examining the expert networks to clients such as hedge funds and mutual funds, which connected managers of companies with investors in a bid to offer inside tracks on financial deals, according to the report. Highlighting a focus on insider trading by the Manhattan U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, the journal noted he has called the issue to a top criminal priority for his post. Illegal insider trading is rampant and may even be on the rise, Bharara warned in a speech last month, pinpointing over a dozen companies based on both U.S. coasts. And the journal reported that a federal grand jury in New York has already heard evidence in parts of the criminal probe. Among those being investigated, the newspaper said prosecutors were examining whether bankers with the Goldman Sachs Group leaked information about transactions, including healthcare mergers, in a bid to benefit investors. Inside traders are generally known to profit after being tipped off on deals ahead of time. For example, giving them an opportunity to buy stocks before acquisitions and then selling them after the shares rise in value. As well as large financial firms like Goldman Sachs, the investigation is also examining independent analysts and research houses for providing non-public information to hedge funds. The report suggests the three-year probe has involved wiretapping the telephone conversations between consultants and investors. In one case, a leading analyst at the small Oregon-based Broadband Research wrote to clients on October 26, explaining the firm was under investigation. Analyst John Kinukan is in an email sent to two hedge funds and two mutual funds, and that was obtained by the journal. Said FBI agents had attempted to get him to help with the probe. The officials were thoroughly convinced that my client had been trading on copious inside information. They obviously have been recording my cell phone conversations for quite some time, and what motivation I have no idea. We obviously beg to differ, so have therefore declined the young gentleman's gracious offer to wear a wire and therefore ensnare you in their devious web, he wrote, according to the journal. In another part of the probe, trading firm First New York Securities anticipated mergers unveiled in 2009 profited from that information. Financial Daily said, citing people close to the investigation. A spokesman for the 250-person firm acknowledged to the Journal that it was one of the more than three dozen firms that had been asked by regulators to provide general information in a widespread inquiry. And so it's, it's amazing. It's amazing. I just wanted to read something else here. This one may be a little too long. I thought I might go into that, but Goldman Sachs says they're doing God's work. And I'm going to move along here, but let's see if I have a couple of video clips that I wanted to play tonight as well. This, for those of you who might know about the recent the conflict in Korea, there's an interesting little short clip here about Ron Paul. This Korea conflict may be orchestrated, and I think I should play this. I will right now. And he says it may be orchestrated to a crisis to boost the American dollar. So let me play that. This is from Alex Jones.
Obviously, North Korea is a horrible monetary dictatorship under Kim Jong-il and now Kim Jong-un, his secretive son. But now North Korea admits in Reuters they were doing drills and firing artillery into a questionable area that North Korea claims. Now North Korea has bombarded an island in the south, killing and maiming quite a few people. The South Korean president says they're preparing to strike the north. The north is talking about annihilating the south. And then I have this RAND Corporation report. RAND lobbies Pentagon for start of war to save U.S. economy. I think back to NATO stirring stuff up with Russia on 888. I have the Obama advisor telling the Financial Times of London, bottom line here is Americans don't believe in President Obama's leadership. Robert Shapiro said he has to find some way between now and demonstrating that he is a leader who can command confidence. And short of a new 9/11 or Oklahoma City, I can't think of how he can do that. We also have neocon leaders telling Obama to attack Iran or start a war. So we see a lot of hype out there to start some type of war or stir one up to boost the dollar and keep this Ponzi scheme going. Your geopolitical take on that, Congressman?
Yeah, it really is frightening when you hear people in our administration or outside the administration literally advocating war as a way to get out of an economic crisis, which is just insane talk. And the whole idea that we're on the verge of a serious attack by North Korea on South Korea or anybody else, they seem to be a little kooky for even implying that. But you wonder how they get motivated to do that because. It's worse than a third world nation. They have weapons, that's all they have, but they don't have any wealth. They can't even feed their people, and they have no more ability to take over South Korea than a man on the moon. I just wished we weren't over there, and if it is a problem, which it may well be, let South Korea take care of it. Let China take care of it. They're close by. They probably don't want another war over there. Japan has interests involved, but we don't, and we need to stay the devil out of there unless they're doing it deliberately and then and sort of orchestrating this in order to have the military-industrial complex benefit and the dollar temporarily benefit. How could the borders over there be anything compared to the borders between Texas and Mexico?
Visit InfoWars.com and PrismPlanet.com. When you're on the site, you can also tune in 24 hours a day to my daily radio broadcast.
Okay, that
also
was
iPhone app. Listen to the syndicated radio.
That was from Ron Paul, that from the InfoWars.com. A good site. I wanted to mention something tonight. There's another article that kind of lays into some of the issues that are being faced in Haiti right now. It's one. It says the article is called "One More Shameful UN Betrayal," and second here. This is from the Guardian.co.uk. Cholera is just the latest disaster to be linked to the UN in Haiti, and the election won't change the nature of the mission. Almost everyone now accepts that the United Nations brought cholera to Haiti last month. The evidence is overwhelming, and many experts, including the head of Harvard University Microbiology Department cholera specialist, John McCalanos, made up their minds to that effect several weeks ago. Poverty and a lack of rudimentary infrastructure compels much of Haiti's population to drink untreated water. But there has been no cholera there for decades, and Haitians have no experience with and therefore little resistance to the disease. All the bacterial samples taken from Haiti, patients are identical and match a strain endemic in southern Asia. Cholera broke out in Nepal over the summer, and in mid-October, a new detachment of Nepalese UN troops arrived at their Haitian base in Marabalaise, near the Artibonite River. And a few days later, Haitians living downstream of the base started to get sick, and the disease spread rapidly through the region. On October 27th, journalists visited Marabalaise and found evidence that untreated waste from UN latrines was pouring directly into an Antibonite tributary. By early November, Mekelanos couldn't see any way to avoid the conclusion that an unfortunate and presumably accidental introduction of the organism occurred as a result of UN troops. Mekelanos and others also refute UN claims that identification of the source should be a low public health priority. Probably as a result of UN negligence, more than 1,200 people are already dead and 20,000 are infected, and the toll is set to rise rapidly over the coming weeks. So when the number and intensity of popular protests against the latest in a series of UN crimes and misadventures in Haiti in recent years, which include scores of killings and hundreds of alleged rapes, rather than examine its role in the epidemic, however, the UN mission has opted to disavow and obfuscation. UN officials have refused to test Nepalese soldiers for the disease or to conduct a public investigation into the origins of the outbreak. Rather than address the concerns of an outraged population, the agency has preferred to characterize the fresh wave of protests as a politically motivated attempt to destabilize the country in the run-up to presidential elections on November 28th. Protesters have been met with tear gas and bullets. So far, at least three have been killed. So far, in fact, so normal. I don't know what that means, but the truth is that the whole UN mission in Haiti is based on a violent, bald-faced lie. It says it is in Haiti to support democracy and the rule of law, but its only real achievement has been to help transfer power from a sovereign people to an unaccountable army. To understand this requires a little historical knowledge. The basic political problem in Haiti, from colonial through post-colonial to neo-colonial times, has always been much the same. How can a tiny and precarious ruling class secure its property and privileges in the face of mass destitution and resentment? The Haitian elite owe its privilege to the exclusion, exploitation, and violence, and only quasi-monopoly control of the violent powers allow it to retain them. This monopoly was amply guaranteed by the U.S.-backed Duvalier dictatorships through to the mid-1980s, and then rather less amply by the military dictatorships that succeeded them in 1986 to 1990. But the Lavalas mobilization for democracy, which began in the 1980s, threatened that monopoly, and with it those privileges. In such a situation, only an army could be relied upon to guarantee the security of the status quo. Well, Haiti's incompetent but vicious armed forces, established as a delegate of U.S. power, dominated the country for most of the 20th century. After surviving a brutal military coup in 1991, Haiti's first democratically elected government, led by the president Jean-Bertrand Aristide, finally demobilized his hated army, in 1995, and the great majority of his compatriots celebrated the occasion. Lawyer Brian Concannon recalls it as the most important step forward for human rights since emancipation from France. In 2000, Aristide was reelected, and his Famille Lavalas party won an overwhelming majority. This reelection raised the prospect for the first time in modern Haiti history of genuine political change in a situation in which there was no obvious extra-political mechanism, no army to prevent it. The tiny Haitian elite and their allies in the U.S., France, and Canada were threatened by the prospect of popular empowerment and took elaborate steps to undermine the Lavalas government. And just got a couple more paragraphs on this. In February 2004, Aristide's second administration was overthrown in another disastrous coup and conducted by the U.S. and its allies with support from ex-Haitian soldiers and right-wing leaders of the Haitian business community. A U.S. puppet was imposed to replace Aristide in the midst of the savage reprisals against the Lavalas supporters. Since no domestic army was available to guarantee security, a U.N. stabilization force was sent in at the behest of both the U.S. and France. And the U.N. has been providing the substitute army ever since. And at the behest of the U.S. and its allies, it arrives in Haiti in June 2004. Made up of troops and police drawn from countries all over the world, it operates at an annual cost that is close to twice the size of Aristide's entire pre-coup budget. Its main mission, in effect, has been to pacify the Haitian people and make them accept the coup and the end of their attempt to establish genuine democratic rule. Few Haitians are likely to forget what the UN has done to accomplish this. And between 2004 and 2006, it participated in the campaign of repression that killed more than 1,000 Lavalese supporters. It laid siege to the destitute pro-Aristide neighborhood of Cité Soleil in 2005 and 2006, and has subsequently contained or dispersed popular protests on issues ranging from political persecution and privatization to wages and food prices. In the last few months, the UN has also kept a lid on the growing pressure in the capital, Port-au-Prince, for improvement in the intolerable conditions still endured by about 1.3 million people left homeless after January's earthquake. Excuse me. Today, cholera or no cholera, the UN's priority is to ensure that next week's election goes ahead as planned. For Haiti's elite and their international allies, these elections offer an unprecedented opportunity to bury the Lavalas project once and for all. The political program associated with Lavalas and Aristide remains overwhelmingly popular. After 6 years of repression and infighting, however, the political leadership of this popular movement is more divided and disorganized than ever. And Famille Lavalas itself has simply been barred from participation in the election, with hardly a whisper of international protest. And from his involuntary exile in South Africa, Aristide has condemned the ballot as illegitimate, and many, if not most, of the party's supporters are likely to back its vigorous call to boycott this latest masquerade, as they did in the spring of 2009, when turnout for Senate elections was less than 10%. This time around, however, half a dozen politicians associated with Lavalas have chosen to run as candidates in their own name. They are likely to split the vote, and Haiti's people will be deprived of what was long been their most powerful political weapon, their ability to win genuine elections. Since it is most guaranteed to have no significant political impact. This is one election that might well achieve its intended result to reinforce the security and equity of the status quo, along with the many profitable opportunities that a suitable, secure post-disaster Haiti continues to offer international investors and its business elite. This will be an election for nothing, says veteran activist Patrick Lee. Properly managed, it may even provide an opportunity for right-wing political presidential candidates like Charles Baker to pursue the goal that has long been at the top of their agenda, restoration, with the usual international supervision of Haiti's own branch of the Imperial Army. And if that comes to pass, then when the UN eventually leaves Haiti, this departure may only serve as a transition from one occupying force to another, and reversing decades of popular sacrifice and political effort. In the meantime, though it looks as if the UN may soon have more opportunities than ever before to fulfill its mission in Haiti. That's scary. There's very, very frightening aspect in Haiti and what's going on there. Sorry, I had to yawn here. I don't know if this is of audio visual audio, why your senators will vote for S-510. S-510 is a frightening bill, and I'll explain it in a second here. The following is a list of U.S. senators and the bribes, and I mean campaign contributions, that these senators received while special interest groups to either support or oppose S-510. The FDA Food Safety and Modernization Act. I have listed the names of the senators, the party, and the state, and the amount of special interest bribes, I mean campaign contributions, that they received. And I don't know if this is the audio here, but we have... what it says here. Okay. Yeah, it's a written one. Hang on. Senators got paid off to support 510. S-510. Here is why what the people want is ignored. Special interests rule you. Going through the 50 senators here to see who got paid off. They all did virtually to vote for S-10. And S-510 is actually a demonic little proposal, a bill in the Senate that is called the FDA Food Safety and Modernization Act, which prevents Americans to prevents organic farming by small farms, tries to prevent people from even growing backyard gardens. It's a demonic little mess of a thing, which we've covered quite extensively on our programs. But it's coming up for a vote on the 29th, and we're urging everybody to check it out and call your senators and check out. And tell them to vote against S-510, all right, which is the FDA Food Safety and Modernization Act. And it's the best I can tell you. I'm just looking here. at something here that says 28% plunge in our standard of living. So what is the most immediate danger for 300 million Americans from the limitless bailout of the most politically powerful special interest group in America, the bankers of Wall Street? Author and financial expert Daniel Ammerman, CFA, illustrates the very real danger of a 12 to 28% plunge in the standard of living for the average American, and shows how it could occur in a matter of weeks or months. And I'm going to play this because I think it sounds quite frightening.
What is the real danger from the financial crisis? Not just the crisis, but the government and the Federal Reserve's response to the crisis, which is to effectively create trillions of dollars out of thin air. Now, what's the immediate danger there for you and for me of the limitless bailout of the most powerful special interest group in America, the bankers of Wall Street? Some people would say a high rate of inflation. Others would say a depression, or both. For the average person, however, let me suggest that there is something that we don't usually think about, a third danger, but something that could drastically transform the day-to-day lives of 300 million Americans within a space of weeks or months. Because the fastest collapse occurs when something wasn't real in the first place. In this presentation, we're going to discuss why about 10% to 30% of your day-to-day standard of living hasn't been real for a number of years now. Because the standard of living that we take for granted is based on our running a massive trade deficit. We consume much more than we produce. And if we're suddenly forced to consume no more than what we actually produce, which is exactly what this financial crisis risks, there would be catastrophic consequences for the American consumer, potentially almost instantly. It's not too late for the U.S. as a nation, for us as individuals, but time is running out fast. And if we're to find effective personal and societal solutions, then we need to clearly understand the true danger. What the trade deficit represents is the difference between what the United States produces as a nation and what the United States consumes as a nation. For instance, in 2008, the U.S. exported about $1.8 trillion worth of goods and services and imported about $2.5 trillion worth, with the difference between what we sold and what we bought being a shortfall of $700 billion. The trade deficit, huge number, but what does it really mean? Let's make it personal. There are 111 million households in the United States. So if we take 700 billion and we divide it by 111 million households, we come up with a trade deficit for the average American family of about $6,300 a year. The median income per American household is about $50,000 per year. So when we put the deficit into personal terms, it means that about 12% of the standard of living of the average American family consists of goods we consume from other nations and that we don't produce enough of our own goods to pay for. What does that mean for your family in practical terms? For an answer, go to any Walmart or other big box retail store or massive retail mall and walk the aisles. You will see row after row of goods ranging from baby clothes to shoes to DVD players, and what they all have in common is that they're made in other countries and we can't actually pay for them. So if other nations stopped letting us have what we can't pay for, we suddenly have many less goods available, and they would cost much more. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean going down from a 50-inch flat-screen TV to a 44-inch flat-screen TV in order to save 12% of the cost, because the key measure here is what's referred to as discretionary income. Do you get to decide how to spend your entire paycheck every month? Not at all. We have to pay the mortgage or rent, which is about 37% of the income for the median household. And we have to pay income taxes and Social Security and Medicare as well. For the average family, the median family, housing and taxes take over half their income, meaning we've only got about $22,500 left per household after housing and taxes. And when we compare our $6,300 per household share of the national trade deficit to what's left after housing and taxes, then we just lost about 28% of our standard of living. 28% of our standard of living, and in every household in America. Then we're no longer talking about new TVs. We're talking about putting gas in the tank because over half of our oil is imported. We're not talking about steak dinners, but about whether we can go to McDonald's. And instead of the latest fashion, we may be rediscovering a quaint historical artifact known as a sewing machine, except I think we buy all those from overseas too, so I'm not sure that will work. How real are the chances of our having a precipitous drop in our standard of living because other nations will no longer provide goods we can't pay for? Well, relationships like this are always unstable when we look back over world history, but this one exists for a reason. China doesn't buy our treasury bonds because they like us. They buy them to prop up the value of the dollar, keeping the dollar artificially high so their goods stay artificially cheap, and their industrial base can grow while ours shrinks. In other words, through currency manipulation, they hollow out our real economy, build their real economy, and we get a temporary, artificially high standard of living. Now, if they cut us off too abruptly, the dollar plunges in value, we can no longer afford to buy their goods, and their economy goes straight into depression too. So they've got their reasons to try to maintain this, but the whole relationship is still quite unstable. Let me suggest that the chances of this unstable relationship falling apart quite abruptly are far higher than they were in the past. One reason is we didn't used to have this huge imbalance, this inability to pay for our own standard of living. And the greater that imbalance, the stronger the forces pushing a correction, pushing us towards finding a natural balance, where we would be without these massive currency manipulations. The other reason is the financial crisis. Trillions of dollars are being created out of thin air. The idea that the U.S. government is trying to preserve the value of the dollar is becoming increasingly difficult to believe. In fact, it's becoming an insult to your intelligence, as I cover in my video, Bailout Big Lies Threaten Your Savings. Now, this is profoundly disrespectful to our creditors. The problem with relying upon other nations to provide your standard of living is that you've just given up control of your standard of living, and you'd better be very respectful of the people who are providing it. With each round of government spending that the government can't actually afford, it ratchets up the chances of a precipitous, entirely real drop in our national standard of living. And now, on a personal level, I do believe that we need to go there. We need to get to the place that our national standard of living is based on what our national economy actually produces. Our national security depends on that. The rebirth of American jobs depends on that. However, the key is how fast we go there. Because if it happens too quickly, we risk national economic catastrophe. What happens if we push it too hard? What happens to the U.S. dollar and the U.S. economy? That will be the subject of the next presentation in this series, Inflation Supply Shock and a Plunging Dollar. Now, let me ask you something. Have you learned anything worthwhile from this presentation? If so, and if you're seeking solutions, let me suggest that the next step is free education. If you would like to read a free book filled with innovative, practical solutions available nowhere else, then I would encourage you to visit my website, danielammerman.com. Good luck to you in these perilous times.
That's kind of interesting. Go to danielammerman.com, check out his stuff. I intend to do that. Let's see what's going on here. Get a better idea of the what's really going on. It's by Daniel Ammerman, A-M-E-R-M-A-N. Check it out. That's on YouTube. Okay. Just going down the road here a little bit. Here's one against, I think it's kind of depressing. I was very disappointed with the American public today. I'm a little more cynical than being disappointed. I didn't expect them to do any kind of boycott or major thing, and most people opted out to go through that FBI scan, to go through the TSA scanners and have themselves x-rayed. Fortunately, I wasn't flying this week, and I think I would have canceled my flight anyway. I'm not a great flyer, and I have to say that. And I hate the discomfort of the small seats, and I hate the, I just don't like flying. And not that I care for driving either, but over flying, I would prefer to fly. I mean, over to flying, I would prefer to drive. But this article is called The Police State USA. TSA Gestapo Empire. This is from globalresearch.ca. It was written by Paul Craig Roberts. Many of you might know a well-known author. It doesn't take a bureaucrat long to create an empire. John Pistole, the FBI agent who took over the Transportation Security Administration on July 1st, told USA Today, 16 days later, that the protecting trains and subways from terrorist attacks will be as high a priority for him as air travel. It is difficult to imagine New Yorkers being porno screened and sexually groped on crowded subway platforms, or showing up an hour or two in advance for clearance for a 15-minute subway ride. But once bureaucrats get the bit in their teeth, they take absurdity to its logical conclusions. Buses will be next. Although it is even more difficult to imagine open-air bus stops turned into security zones, with screeners and gropers inspecting passengers before they board. Will taxi passengers be next? In those Muslim lands whose citizens the U.S. government has been slaughtering for years, favorite weapons for retaliating against the Americans are car and truck bombs. How long before Pistole announces that the TSA Gestapo is setting up roadblocks on city streets, highways, and interstates to check cars for bombs? That 15-minute trip to the grocery store then becomes an all-day affair. Indeed, it has already begun. Last September, agents from Homeland Security, TSA, and the U.S. Department of Transportation, assisted by the Douglas County Sheriff's Office, conducted a counterterrorism operation on busy Interstate 20, just west of Atlanta, Georgia. Designated Viper, Visible Intermobile Prevention and Response, the operation required all trucks to stop to be screened for bombs. Federal agents used dog screening devices and a large drive-through bomb detection machine. And images, imagine what the delay did to delivery schedules and truckers' bottom lines. There are also news reports of federal trucks equipped with backscatter X-rays, devices that secretly scan cars and pedestrians. What such expensive counterterrorism activities, both in terms of the hard-pressed taxpayers' money and civil liberties, one would think that bombs were going off all over America, But of course they aren't. And there has not been a successful terrorist act since 9/11. Thousands of independent experts doubt the government explanation of that event. Subsequent domestic terrorist events have turned out to be FBI sting operations in which FBI agents organize not-so-bright, disaffected members of society and lead them into displaying interest in participating in a terrorist act. Once the FBI agent pretended to be a terrorist, succeeds in promoting all the right words to be said and captured on his hidden recorder, the terrorists are arrested and the plot exposed. The very fact that the FBI has to orchestrate fake terrorism proves the absence of real terrorists. If Americans were more thoughtful and less gullible, they might wonder why all the emphasis is on transportation when there are so many soft targets. Shopping centers, for example. If there were enough terrorists in America to justify the existence of Homeland Security, bombs would be going off around the clock in shopping malls in every state, and the effect would be far more terrifying than blowing up an airliner. Indeed, if terrorists want to attack air travelers, they never need to board an airplane. All they need to do is to join the throngs of passengers waiting to go through the TSA scanner and set up their bombs. And the TSA has inconveniently assembled the targets. Unbelievable. The TSA has conveniently assembled the targets. The final proof that there are no terrorists is that not a single neoconservative or government official responsible for the Bush regime invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan and the Obama regime slaughter of Pakistanis, Yemenis, and Somalians has been assassinated. None of these Americans who are responsible for lies, deceptions, and invasions that have destroyed the lives of countless numbers of Muslims have any security protection. If Muslims were capable of pulling off 9/11, they are certainly capable of assassinating Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Feith, Libby, Condi Rice, Crystal, Bolton, Goldberg, and scores of others during the same hours of the same day. I am not advocating that terrorists assassinate anyone. I'm just making the point that if the U.S. was an overrun with terrorists, as empire-building bureaucrats pretend, we would definitely be experiencing dramatic terrorist attacks. And the argument is not believable that a government that was incapable of preventing 9/11 is so all-knowing that it can prevent assassination of unprotected neocons and shopping malls from being bombed. If Al-Qaeda was anything like the organization the U.S. government claims, it would not be focused on trivial targets such as passenger airlines. The organization, if it exists, would be focused on the real enemies. Try to imagine the propaganda value of the terrorists wiping out the neoconservatives in one fell swoop, followed by an announcement that every member of the federal government, down to the lowest GS, every member of the House and Senate, and every government was next in line to be bumped off. This would be real terrorism, instead of the make-believe stuff associated with shoe bombs that don't work, underwear bombs that independent experts say could not work, and bottled water and shampoo bombs that experts say cannot possibly be put together in airline laboratories. Think about it. Would a terror organization capable of outwitting all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, all intelligence agencies of U.S. allies, including Israel's Mossad, the Nation's Security Council, and NORAD, air traffic control, the Pentagon, and airport security, four times in 1 hour, put its unrivaled prestige at risk with improbable shoe bombs, shampoo bombs, and underwear bombs? After success in destroying the World Trade Center and blowing up part of the Pentagon, it is an extraordinary come down to go after a mere airliner. Would a person who gains fame by knocking out the world heavyweight boxing champion make himself a laughingstock by taking lunch money from schoolboys? TSA is a far greater threat to Americans than our terrorists. Pistole has given the finger to U.S. senators and representatives, state legislators, and the traveling public who have expressed their views that virtual strip searches and sexual molestation are too high a price to pay for security. Indeed, the TSA and its Gestapo attitude and methods is succeeding in making Americans more terrified of the TSA than they are of terrorists. Make up your own mind. What terrifies you the most? Terrorists who are, in all likelihood, you will never encounter in your lifetime? Or the TSA that you will encounter every day you fly, and soon, according to Pistoli, every time you take a train, a subway, or drive in a truck, or a car? Before making up your mind, consider this report from antiwar.com on November 19th. TSA officials say that anyone refusing both the full body scanners and the enhanced pat-down procedures will be taken into custody. Once there, the detainees will not only be barred from flying, but will be held indefinitely as suspected terrorists. One sheriff's office said they were already preparing to handle a large number of detainees and planned to treat them as terrorist suspects. Who is cowing Americans into submission? Terrorists or the TSA Gestapo? That is very good. That's from Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. He wrote it for, globalresearch.ca. Quite frightening. Here's one for the. Here's one that pisses me off. Has for quite some time. But what's going on in Israel right now is just it's just an abomination. These Israeli settlements, it's just an absolute abomination, and it has to be stopped. Jewish settlers move into a house after Israeli police evict a Palestinian family. This is today. Jewish settlers moved into a house in East Jerusalem after Israeli police evicted a Palestinian family of 14 and removed all of their possessions. The move will dismay U.S. officials who are striving to discourage settler activity in East Jerusalem in an attempt to restart stalemate talks between Israel and Palestinians. Armed police arrived early this morning in the area of Jabal Makabur, a new target for ideologically driven settler activists, following a court ruling that ownership of the house was now in Jewish hands. And three removal trucks took away the family's belongings as they watched from a neighbor's house. Scores of heavily armed police surrounded the area, initially refusing to let non-residents through makeshift checkpoints. This is outright theft, folks. Outright theft. At the property, several muscular Israeli men refused to identify themselves or explain what they were doing. One who had carried two flak jackets inside says, "This is a private home. Nothing is happening here. Have a good day." The sound of drilling and hammering could be heard well on ground outside. The housemen equipped with bolt cutters measuring up heavy-duty steel window shields. But Fadi Karim, 21, a member of the evicted family, said, "They came when I was asleep. People came with loaded weapons aiming them at us and told us to get out. We knew it was coming, but we had no warning of today. We knew settlers warned to take over the place." Ask how he felt. He said, "I can't even speak." A neighbor, Rab Karim, 36, said the newcomers were the first Jewish settlers in the area. "It's not good. It's a problem," he said. "Now they will bring in security. My children won't be able to play on the street. My son is already scared of the police." Anti-settlement activists at the scene claimed that Elad, an organization that finances Jewish settlement in Arab neighborhoods of Jerusalem, are behind the purchase of the house. The Karim family claimed the house was inherited by five siblings following the death of the owner, one of whom sold his stake to Wool Investments, a company said to be the front for Elad. Other signatures to the sale were forged, they said. An Israeli Israeli court ruled the sale was legal. Yeah, what a freaking kangaroo court, isn't it? Police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld said that the contents of the house had been removed on a court order based on the fact that the house was sold by the Israeli Arab family to a Jewish family. The family had not been in the house at the time, he said, and the possessions were removed in three vans in an operation that took 3.5 hours. The police present was to prevent disorder. Arif Sharon, an Israeli activist from Solidarity Movement, said settlers are now closing off the entrances, turning it into a fortress, bringing in guards. It's the usual drill. This is how they start a new settlement. In a statement, he said, the new settlement is without doubt meant to worsen the tensions between Washington and Jerusalem and set fire to the powder keg that is East Jerusalem. Residents of Jerusalem will pay the price for this despicable cooperation between the fundamentalist wing of the settlers' movement and the Jerusalem police. There are already a number of highly volatile settlements in the heart of Arab neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, such as the Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. These are orchestrated by politically motivated activists and are distinct from the big Jewish settlements in the east of the city, although all are illegal under international law. East Jerusalem was captured by Israel in the 1967 Six-Day War and later annexed in a move not recognized internationally. The U.S. has made clear its disapproval of any expansion of Jewish presence in East Jerusalem, and the issue is becoming a stumbling block for the resumption of talks. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu wants Barack Obama to exempt in writing East Jerusalem from a second temporary freeze on settlement construction. The U.S. is so far refusing to do so. That's from, I believe, UKRNet. Yeah, UKRNet.info. This is interesting. You think your nuclear weapons are safe? U.S. nuclear agents drunk on duty. The U.S. Department of Energy has launched an investigation into claims of alcohol abuse among agents transporting nuclear weapons across the country. The DOE Assistant Inspector General Sandra Bruce recently released the results of her probe into the alleged alcohol abuse of federal agents, on duty at the Office of Secure Transportation. The report substantiated a total of 16 alcohol-related incidents of abuse by OST agents, from 2007 to 2009. Drunkenness, whereas two others were detained after an incident occurred at a bar while they were on overnight missions, state-funded BBC said. OST, which is under the Department of Energy's National Nuclear Security Administration, transports nuclear weapons, weapons components, and special nuclear material across the United States. OST management took what appeared to be appropriate action in these cases. However, in our judgment, the investigator wrote, alcohol incidents such as these, as infrequent as they may be, indicate a potential vulnerability in OST's critical national security mission. Meanwhile, Meanwhile, a spokesman for National Security Administration states that the Office of Secure Transportation maintains a highly trained, highly professional force that has safely and securely transported nuclear materials more than 100 million miles without a single fatal accident or any release of radiation. He added that there has also been no incidents of agents drunk driving while on duty. All right, well, that's scary enough. That doesn't bother you. I don't know what else will. I guess that's about it. Yeah, I don't see anything else today. I was hoping to have one more clip to go out with here tonight. But I'll plug it. Let's see. I'm curious. Georgetown professor tells Congress Citigroup, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo are all insolvent. And it's about 4 minutes long, but we've got about 3 minutes remaining. So I'm going to continue with this and wish you all a very good weekend.
I am very deeply troubled about some of the allegations that have been made about improper fraudulent servicing and foreclosure processing. And one example, a constituent of mine from Whitehall seeking a modification from Bank of America was told by a servicing associate that while the loan modification was in review, the homeowner should not make any mortgage payments. Let me repeat that. He was told by their servicer, Bank of America, not to make any payments, and that if they did, they wouldn't qualify for modification. The gentleman from Helena, how is it possible he would receive a letter indicating that he is in foreclosure before foreclosure processing is restarted in the state of Montana? There's no doubt in my mind this is not isolated. Montana is not a state where people come to the U.S. Senator just willy-nilly. At a minimum, we need to understand these risks before the Fed moves forward with guidance allowing banks to increase dividends because, quite frankly, there ain't going to be any more bailouts. I mean, to be honest with you, some heads have to roll if they're given that kind of advice. That's just the way it is.
Senator Merkley, because we have millions of people in this country that are underwater in their mortgages, right? We know that. I, for one, don't believe that it's possible to prop up the value of all of these houses. That's impossible. And that it would be foolish public policy to do. Why can't we get all of this self-interest aligned in a way that will allow us to proceed expeditiously so that not just so that my constituents can get on with their lives, which they desperately want to do, but so that we can get this economy moving again? Professor.
I think there are at least two problems. One problem is mortgage servicers, and I think you've heard a fair amount of testimony already this hearing about the incentive alignment problem. Simply put, foreclosure is either less costly or more profitable than modification in many cases. The second problem...
Not as far as the investors are concerned.
No, this
right.
is the servicers representing right. their own financial interests, which are... The servicers' financial interests do not match the investors. The second problem... problem is it comes with loans that are not even that are not being serviced by a third-party servicer, but with loans that are actually on bank books. There is a strong disincentive for banks to recognize losses on mortgages quickly.
What percentage would you say?
Around 40% of mortgages in this country are not securitized. We don't actually know how many mortgages there are in the U.S., which is just kind of an astounding failure, regulatory failure to gather information. No one knows the number, somewhere between 50 and 60 million. But of the mortgages that are on bank books, if the loan defaults, the bank can stretch out the period of time before foreclosure. That means that the bank is stretching out the time before it has to recognize the loss. If the bank modifies the loan now, let's say it writes down principal now, it's taking an immediate loss, and this is particularly a problem with second liens because almost all second lien mortgages are on banks' books. There are around $400 billion in second lien mortgages out there. That is roughly held by the four largest banks, Bank of America, Chase, Citi, and Wells. That's roughly equal to the market capitalization of those four banks. So if they started writing off their second lien mortgages, they would have no capital left. They would be insolvent. And that creates a strong incentive not to recognize losses and to do extended and just try and pretend that they aren't there.
So that's what it is. It's more profitable for these banks to put it off, all right, and service the loan, than even though the loan is going bad, because they're all insolvent. That's Citigroup, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo. Those four major banks are all insolvent because they can't, because all of their loans are bad. So what they're doing is actually extending the death by, preventing their loss by servicing the loans or because they can't afford to foreclose on these things. So because it would show up on their balance sheet. That's it for tonight. One other thing, probably not great to mention, but I feel I should. 1 in 5 Americans, come to pass, 1 in 5 Americans are food insecure here on Thanksgiving Eve. And my heartfelt sympathy goes out to them. And we hope your situation gets better. And in the meantime, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Hope you have a good weekend. And join us here Friday night with George Dixon. And I believe Lila will be with us at that point. But Friday night. And have a good weekend.